this truth of a head. It gets beyond all the headlines you read. Don't need lip service with a wink and a nod. You need a man on a mission from God. Well, not to worry, here's Bob Kenyard.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to another episode of Real Science Friday. I'm Bob Kenyard.
And I'm Fred Williams, software engineer and creation speaker.
Fred, what a great idea you came up with for today's show. Is this your idea?
Well, actually, it's not my idea, Bob. It's a listener of ours, a Hollywood producer, who wrote into the show and asked that we talk about an article that appeared in Nature magazine called The 15 Evolutionary Gems.
It's kind of
like
gems.
15 gems. It's like their best evidence for evolution.
All right.
And it's basically their evangelism tract to their faithful. They pretty much describe it as that, and to spread the word of evolution as established fact.
It's the atheist chick track for evolution.
Exactly.
Right. Fred, they list 15 gems of evolution, but what's interesting is the things that are not in the list.
There's some things not in the list, some icons of evolution that are missing.
Here's an example, and these would be so much stronger in their evidence for evolution if they were true, but they've been so debunked as incorrect, frauds, twisted information. So, for example, remember the peppered moths?
Yeah, where's that in this list? It's missing.
Then there's ontogeny, recapitulates phylogeny, that whole argument that they said the embryo had gill slits. Supposedly, the developing fetus goes through the stages of evolutionary history. Also, remember the Stanley Miller amino acid in the test tube?
Oh, yeah, another great one.
They get some chemicals in a test tube. That's not in here. The evolutionary tree of life from Darwin. How about the bone structures that are similar in bat wings and flippers and the human hand? They used to say, look, this is proof of evolution. Now they know it's way more difficult than it ever would be evidence.
Yeah, so you don't have the homology argument, so you don't look at similar bat wings or robin wings or joker wings or penguin wings.
Yeah. Oh, penguin wings.
Sorry.
And then there's sickle cell anemia. That's not here. Fruit flies with extra wings. That's not here. Horse fossils. Remember the horse fossils from the small Eohippus up to the large?
So no horse evolution.
Equus. Yeah, that's missing. The ape-to-man hominid fossil parade, that's not here. So, Fred, the
Where's
vast,
Lucy?
Where's Lucy? In
that's
the sky
a favorite evolutionist argument.
So the vast majority of the icons of evolution have been utterly debunked, so here's a new set. They got 15 gems of evolution.
That's right. So, and just a few other ones quickly, Bob. Junk DNA isn't here.
Oh, yeah.
Chimp-human DNA similarity being 97%.
Oh, yeah.
Those are all been so thoroughly debunked, they don't show up on this list.
Yeah, what a great point. So, you've done an article on this, the Gems of Evolution from Nature magazine. And, Fred, you point out, as other creationists have, that for starters, 12 of their 15 gems refer to just minor, small-scale changes of variability within a kind of animal that everyone agrees occurs. Creationists and evolutionists all agree that you can have offspring and they might get a little smaller, a little taller, a little fatter. They might change their color a little bit. But that's not evidence of developing new organs or new functionality or new genes.
Yeah, so here they've got 80% of their arguments are talking about small-scale change that creationists, even before Darwin, have talked about, and that is not evidence of, you know, growing a new tail or a new organ or eyesight. Right. It's not large-scale change. Evolutionists call it microevolution.
Yeah.
They wanted to get the word evolution in there as a somewhat of an illusion to try to sell the fact that, hey, this is evidence for evolution, but it's not. It's small-scale change. Everybody agrees it occurs. There's no debate on that. Mm-hmm. And yet, 12 of their 15 arguments, as you mentioned, are small-scale change.
Which implies that they don't have really good arguments.
Exactly.
So could we look at these, what they do have? They don't have evidence of the development of eyesight, for example. That'd really be fun. But let's look at their 15 arguments. What's the first one?
The first one is land-living ancestors of whales.
Whales. So, okay, don't they say that mammals evolved from marine life, that originally life started in the sea and then it came to land?
Yeah, which made sense for them because in the, obviously in the fossil record, you're going to find, you know, your marine life towards the bottom. It's common sense.
Because of the global flood, so creatures in water were buried first as sediments filled the seas and the lakes. And so anyway, that's what they think. Life started with marine life.
Well, and I think God has a sense of humor.
Yeah.
Because he went and put a mammal right back in the water.
He put a mammal in the sea.
A whale is a mammal.
With and these so whales.
They've got to come up with a reason. They've got to try to explain what are whales doing
they
back
have live,
in the water.
Young. They nurse their young, right? Whales.
Yep.
And they breathe oxygen. They don't have gills. And so these are mammals that live in the sea. But if land creatures evolved out of the sea, what's the whale doing a mammal back in the sea?
That's right. And as incredibly complex as it is with sonar and its buoyancy mm-hmm. characteristics is incredibly complex.
And our brain anatomy is more similar.
Well, here's the argument the evolutionists use. They talk about these creatures like Pachycetus and Ambulocetus and these things that are wolf-like animals as examples of whale ancestors because they have slight similarities in their ear structure, for example. So they see a slight similarity and they say, ah, ha, ha, we found the whale ancestor.
Right. Whales must have evolved from these wolf-like creatures.
And yet if you do a search on the internet for other similarities between whales and other life, you find out that whales and humans show greater similarity in brain anatomy. So why are we not saying that whales evolved from humans?
Which seems very possible because humans like to go swimming.
Well, you remember the incredible Mr. Limpet, right? Don Knotts?
That's evidence also in the culture. So, Fred, there are similarities between sponges and humans. So what? Maybe sponges evolved from humans going swimming. This is all so trivial and so embarrassing, and so that's their number one gem of evolution.
Yeah, the first one on their list.
Okay.
So the next one is from water to land. So now we're to the point where they say that marine life evolved over time into terrestrial life.
So first they were fish, and then they came and crawled on land. And so, yeah,
became
and
a
that,
frog, then
we
a
did a show on this, that fossil Tiktaalik.
Yes, Tiktaalik.
Which
that
was supposedly the proof they had the transitional form when land animals began to walk. It was from this creature.
Yeah, they thought they finally had the missing link. And interestingly, Bob, just recently they discovered footprints in strata of tetrapods. And now that's, you know, land life, mammals.
Four-legged creatures. Indisputable footprints.
They found them in strata from their time scale are 10 million years before Tiktaalik. So, oops, that's a big problem for them. In fact,
and they're admitting it, right?
Yeah,
one
evolutionist scientist said, we thought we'd pin down the origin of limbed tetrapods. We have to rethink the whole thing.
Yeah.
So here's their second gem, and it's already been refuted.
It's already been debunked.
It's already been debunked, and this happened after this article in Nature magazine was written in 2009.
Okay, so then we have number three, that dinosaurs evolved into birds, and of course they've got their Archaeopteryx, but also the Epidexipteryx.
We got
Archaeopteryx and the newcomer Epidexipteryx. Epidexipteryx.
That's good, Bob. That sounds right.
Fred. Thank you. So what's with this Epidexipteryx, Fred? It doesn't seem to be the story that they like to tell.
Yeah. In fact, they even admit in the article that was published on this creature.
In their own publication,
that it could be a secondarily flightless bird.
Now, secondarily flightless bird, that's not as exciting as a dinosaur evolving into a bird.
That's right.
A secondarily flightless bird is a bird that through mutations which deteriorate their functionality can no longer fly.
Yeah. And if you do research on this, the articles, the evolutionist articles say that they're not really sure about the timeline. So they put this thing older than Archaeopteryx because... They
want it to tell a nice story.
They do, because Archaeopteryx, they admit, has full-featured flying capability. And they claim that this Epidexipteryx has primitive feathers. So they have to try to cook up a story that shows a lineage from this creature they found. It's really just another bird that they found in the fossil record.
That lost its ability to fly, and that's not all that exciting for evolution gaining functionality, where here's one that had it and lost it.
Yeah, and you know, the interesting thing is there's a lot of evolutionists who dispute this whole dino bird link, at least the way it's presented by a lot of these scientists. I love what one evolutionist said. He said, you have to put this into perspective. To the people who wrote the paper, the chicken would be a feathered dinosaur. Now, he's referring to another one of their goofy claims of a feathered dinosaur.
Right.
But there's a lot of even evolutionists who argue against this. So if it's such a powerful argument, Bob, why are they using one that they're even their own question?
Right. And so the fourth argument is about teeth. And Fred, this is so typical, and there's another podcast called ID the Future. It's not Christian, but it's the Intelligent Design group out at Discovery Institute. And they point out that so many of these examples come from articles about, like, teeth. This one is teeth in mice.
Yeah, all it is different sized teeth in mice based on their ecological pressures in the environment they're in. Now, that's adaptation towards an environment.
Right. And so they'll have a very interesting article looking at the teeth in mice. And then at the end of the article, as is true of most of these 15, they have articles for each of these. And at the end, they have their evolutionary gloss. They have their obligatory statement that, wow, isn't it neat what evolution can do? Whereas the article itself is not looking at evolutionary mechanisms and how evolution could do this. It's just an article about, wow, look at this, what happens with mice and their teeth. And they say, look, there's proof of evolution.
Yeah. And so number five is the origin of the vertebrate skeleton. Mm. And you know, Bob, when I read this one in their evangelism tract, I couldn't find any argument for evolution. I couldn't find an argument. Basically, they just talked about how complex this was, and it was an argument for intelligent design.
Yeah, and the origin of the vertebrate skeleton, Fred, we did a show a while back, Real Science Friday. I interviewed a chiropractor, Dr. John Hanks, and he talked about the slightest little deformation or problem in your spinal column, and you are going to be laid up maybe for weeks. And he said, now just imagine that we don't have all these vertebrae and all the padding between them, and it's just coming together by accident, bit by bit. He said the whole species would be dead in a matter of weeks. They'd die of starvation. They wouldn't be able to move if your sophisticated spinal column is just coming together by accident, bit by bit.
And see, Bob, I could maybe kind of believe it if we found a bunch of chiropractors in the fossil record, but we haven't.
Right, who were very wealthy.
That's right.
All right, so this is another classic example of small-scale adaptation that we know is in the genome. And Fred, so many of the variations we see, like in dogs, for example, when we breed dogs, all that variation is in the genome. And it's only finding opportunities to express itself.
Exactly. Now, you're talking on number six now, which is natural selection and speciation. This is their sixth gem of evolution.
Sixth.
Yeah, the sixth one, and you've just talked about it. They gave an example of a stickleback fish with different body sizes. So that's like saying the St. Bernard evolved from the Chihuahua.
Yeah, right. Whereas they're all dogs. They're canines. They're all dogs. And we know that breeders, even by accident or intentionally or through natural variation of their ecology, their environments, different resources within the genome can express itself as some dogs end up smaller or furrier. Some dogs are taller. Some are stronger. They have different colors. And Fred, none of that is evolution. The one species is not evolving into another species.
And yet, here it is one of their big evidences. Now, if we go to number seven, it's called natural selection in lizards. Hmm. Here we just talked about dogs. Now we're talking about lizards, and the lizard is still a lizard.
Right.
What happens is there's been examples of lizards with slightly different pads on their feet, and it's an adaptation to their environment. That's not evolution. In fact, it happens so rapidly that it can't be due to a mistake in the DNA.
So many changes, like with bacteria that end up with resistance to antibiotics. The resistance is developed so quickly and so regularly around the world in 1,000 laboratories that it turns out that many, not all, but many of these examples are pre-programmed response to challenges or stresses in the environment. And so you don't have to wait thousands of generations and go through millions of possible variations of some protein before you strike on one that will help the species survive.
That's right. And so here again, number eight, another example, it's called coevolution. And what they do is they provide an example of what they call an arms race between water fleas and the parasites that infest them.
Yeah.
As the water fleas become better at evading parasitism, the parasites become better at infecting them. And so what's interesting in this paper, and you've already touched on it, they quote, I'll quote from the article, it says the parasite adapted to its host over a period of only a few years.
Only a few years, Fred. It's supposed to take thousands of years or millions of years because evolution happens so slowly, you know, that we can't see it.
That's right.
But yeah, you have bacteria. Here you have this example of parasites and water fleas, and they are responding to one another rapidly, the way fish in a lake, if you introduce a predator, within the next generation, they're laying more eggs and they're maturing more rapidly because it's a pre-programmed response to a predatory environment.
Yeah. Well, evolution requires the mutation to be random. They want it to be an accident. How can all these parasites get the same accident at the same time? It's not possible.
In a short period of time.
I've got from a college textbook, evolutionary college textbook, that the author says the argument that adaptively directed mutations does not occur is one of the fundamental tenets of modern evolutionary theory.
Now, that is a tremendous quote. That's from evolutionary biology,
It's a college textbook. I got that from a CU
textbook.
That they use that at a University of Colorado.
Yeah. And so, Fred, can I translate that into amateurese?
You sure can.
Okay. Here's this very well-known evolutionist, author of a college textbook, who says, look, mutations do not occur in a directed way. There is no purpose or design for the mutation. We evolutionists, we have to insist that the mutations are accidental, that they're random. There is no direction. So if you have fish in a pond and you introduce a predator, you can't have mutations that are trying to evade the predator.
Yeah, it has to happen over, if it's going to be an accident, a mistake, it has to happen over a great period of time. And even that's not a tenable story.
Right.
But so they're providing examples of things that happen way too fast for it to be an accident. It has to be on purpose.
Which is the opposite then. It's not evolution evidence. It's evidence of pre-programmed response to the environment, which is strong evidence against evolution and for design.
It is. It's a powerful evidence for design, and that's why they don't want any part of non-random mutations. Now, I loved the fact that they quoted the Red Queen and Alice in Wonderland.
Alice in Wonderland through the looking glass?
They quoted that for this particular argument about the flea and the parasite.
Oh, I see their quote. Let me read it here.
Okay.
They said, it takes all the running you can do to keep in the same place. If you want to get somewhere else, you must run at least twice as fast as that.
That's right. Well, on my website, I've got a list of quotes, and I've got one from the Red Queen from Alice in Wonderland also.
Oh, yeah?
She also said, sometimes I've believed as many as six impossible things before breakfast.
Oh, that's right.
I think the Red Queen was an evolutionist.
Must have been. This is fun, Fred. So number nine has to do with the dispersal of wild birds.
That's right. And here's an interesting quote from the article. It says, the effect is reinforced by non-random dispersal. Individual birds select and breed in different habitats in a way that increase their fitness.
Okay, so what we have then are birds. Some birds, they live out there in the wild, and they'll say, you know what, I like these wetlands a little bit more than that forest over there. So we're going to go and breed in these wetlands, and that's going to affect our diet and our environment and our built-in response, our genetic response to our environment.
Yeah, and again, they admit in the article that it can be rapid and it can occur over surprisingly small spatial scales.
So,
translated, this
rapidly,
is not a random mutation.
Rapidly and non-random,
yeah.
And which is opposite the evidence against Darwinism.
That's right.
Okay, so number 10 How about guppies?
Guppies, okay. Selective survival of wild guppies.
Because they change colors.
Yeah, less common guppies of a certain color had higher survival rates.
Yeah, that's a shock.
Yeah.
So, like so many other adaptations, if the color change is a pre-programmed genetic response to the environment, this is a powerful argument against Darwinian evolution, random change. And Fred, as you point out, they don't show any evidence that the color change was random.
That's right. Where's the evolutionary mechanism that's required? There's two big things for evolution theory. It's natural selection and random mutations. And they always avoid the random mutation part.
Mm-hmm.
So number 11 is evolutionary history matters. And this is an argument about a moray eel that evolved the ability to suck down its prey. Now, Bob, from what I understand, you've had some encounters with eels?
Yeah, a moray eel snorkeling off the coast of Oahu on the windward side of the island. And Fred, I went up to a cliff underwater in this reef area, and not a good idea there because I went to look at one of the cracks in the cliff. And just as you could expect, this moray eel came out at me with his jaws wide apart like he's going to bite my face off. It scared the living daylights out of me.
Wow.
And I'm glad I was quick enough and he maybe wasn't hungry enough and I got away. But I'm glad that moray eel didn't evolve in such a way that it could have swallowed me.
Well, apparently it has a design where the jaw moves forward into the mouth cavity and it traps the prey and then drags it backwards.
It's different from all the other bony fish that swallow their prey differently. So what they've done is they point out, hey, look, the moray eel, because we took a video camera and we watched how it captures its food, it grabs and swallows the food differently than all other fish. That's a great observation. That doesn't prove it evolved.
This one was really silly. I saw, again, in this article, in this particular tract, no evidence why this supports evolution. It's just a great feature of design. They call it the contingent nature of evolution. Maybe to try to sway a unsuspecting audience, oh, that sounds like neat language. I'm going to believe it. It's somehow
right.
Supports evolution.
Right. And so this is like so many other examples in this list. It's an evolutionary gloss at the end of an article that has nothing to do with evolution, and it's just an obligatory statement to pay homage to Darwin. Look what evolution could do. How about number 12?
Number 12, Darwin's Galapagos finches. Hey, this made the list. This has been one of the famous ones.
It did make the list, and it's funny because the Grants who've been down there for decades, they say only God and the Grants could distinguish between Darwin's finches. And Fred, this is another example of pre-programmed response to the environment because the finches have longer or shorter beaks based on what food is available on these different islands.
That's right. And again, evolutionists say that this has to have happened by accident over millions of years. That's their theory. But yet they'll say in this particular example, again, they'll admit that this happens rapidly.
Happens rapidly. Like if you have a monsoon season or you have a lot of rain, and so you get certain kind of seeds or certain kind of insects, and the birds could use a long, skinny beak or a short, stout beak, then those responses happen within a couple few years, not over thousands of years going through accidental variations.
That's right, because when an accident occurs, say, to one organism in a population, he's the only one that has the accident. His offspring, only half of them are going to get it.
Right.
And then they have to survive and pass it down to their offsprings.
Right.
It should take eons of time.
Yeah.
And their mistakes. So they're actually going to be detrimental. So
this is an icon of evolution they kept for only one reason, because Saint Darwin's name is attached to it.
That's right.
Darwin's Galapagos finches. How about number 13? It's talking about their term microevolution and macroevolution.
Well, what's amazing is the example he provides is a gene that produces two different functions. That's incredibly complex. That's remarkably complex.
A gene that does two different things, like it's like, say, a Hox gene or a developmental regulatory gene, and then it's a gene that's used for pigmentation of the skin.
Two different things at the same time. That's pretty hard to do.
That same gene. So, Fred, they lose sight of their goal. Their goal is to show that by natural processes and mutations that a gene can develop. That's their goal. And so what they do is they find a gene with double duty. It's doing double duty, and they say, see, that proves the gene evolved by natural processes. No, it doesn't.
It makes it more difficult to explain it as some naturalistic, random accident.
So it doesn't show that. Okay, so how about number 14?
Number 14 is toxic resistance in snakes and clams. Again, we've got a case here of the snake is still a snake, but as we've talked many times before, the snake has the ability, programmed into its genome, the ability to adapt to a certain situation. And the same with the clam. And they even mentioned that the clam, only a single mutation causes it
to resist some kind of toxin.
That's right.
And it's too often to
it's
be random.
Way too often to be random.
Right. And there's no evidence showing that they're increasing the genetic information, which you need to go from an amoeba to man. And then number 15, Fred, they talk about variation. And if you take fruit flies and you put them under stress as they're developing, you get all kinds of variation.
Yeah, and they're all harmful.
And they're all harmful. And in the end, a fruit fly is a fruit fly is a fruit fly.
And most of the time when they're doing this, they can't fly anymore because of all the mutations.
Yeah,
so
and they get millions of experiments, and they're still fruit flies.
Yeah, because they've got such a short reproductive life, it's a great thing to try to test your theory of evolution on, and they keep coming up with nothing.
All right, so Nature Magazine's 15 Gems of Evolution. Fred, if they've got really great evidence, they must be hiding it in a vault. I think you have to subscribe before they'll share it with you. Because this stuff is pitiful. And Fred, Rocky Mountain Creation Fellowship, they meet the second Friday of every month. And coming up is Kevin Swanson, Colorado's homeschool leader. And he'll be speaking on creation. That'll be great.
That's right. Next Friday, December 10th at 7 o'clock at Bethlehem Lutheran Church.
Amen. KGov.com.
Hey, science fans. Now you can have all of the Real Science Friday shows on MP3 CD from 2007, 2008, or 2009. Hear Bob and Fred present the compelling scientific evidence that the Earth is young and that there is a creator. Real Science Friday 2007, 2008, and 2009 are each available by calling 1-800-8-NYART. Or you can get the MP3 CDs or the MP3 downloads at kgovstore.com. You can support the ministry of Bob Enyart Live by subscribing to Bob's monthly Bible studies, monthly videos, monthly sermons, or monthly classic TV shows at kgovstore.com. You can also support the show and make a monthly or one-time donation by calling 1-800-8-ENYART or at kgovstore.com. That's kgovstore.com.